We're recording.
We are recording.
Here we
Hello.
are. First time.
It's happening.
It's
That's right.
happening.
From different ends of the world. Hello and
Indeed.
welcome.
Hello and
Hello.
welcome to you,
Welcome.
and welcome to our listeners.
That's right. Welcome to the pilot episode of our podcast. And we're
Indeed.
very excited about this series, a podcast series where we analyze the pop culture narrative and its most significant people, moments, highs, and lows. I am Viken Karkuklee, coming to you from Louisville, Kentucky.
And I'm Georgie Statius, coming to you from Melbourne, Australia. And I should say, when we reference that it's the most significant in how we view them as significant, and perhaps how we're viewing the media viewing who's significant.
Absolutely, 100%. And maybe we should start by explaining what we're doing, why we're doing this together,
Yeah,
Georgie.
what are we doing? Why are we here?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So tell me, Vicky, tell me about yourself.
I am French born, French raised, and I live in the States at the moment, but you've known me for about 18 years now, Georgie. So
I have.
we met in the event world, working in media operations at an international event in 2006 in Doha, Qatar. And we've been friends ever since. We'll talk about the foundation of our friendship in a minute because that's interesting as well. But yes, so I am a journalist by trade. I've worked as a journalist, I've worked as a media operations specialist all around the world, and I've worked as a teacher as well. So very interested in anything that has to do with discourse and media coverage and academics. So it felt natural to kind of dive into the pop culture world from that perspective and to do it with you because we have, as you're going to tell us in a sec, a very complementary experience.
We do, and I come to this with, I guess you're on the journalism side. I'm probably on the other side, which is the communications and PR side, with a very passionate interest in pop culture. Studying, sorry, something just popped up on my screen that distracted me. Viewers, listeners, I should say, you're not viewing this, you're listening to this. Dating back to my university degree, which was a Bachelor of Media Arts, which included studying theoretical foundations of the media, so really deep diving into the practical and the theory of pop culture. And then I have had a long career in events and PR and communications, but of course met you in the event world, in the media operations world. So I have dabbled on the other side a little bit. And of course we bonded over our love of, well, human nature, I do believe, is where we probably first really connected. But we then realized we had actually been in the same room 6 years prior at a very significant sporting moment, which was the opening ceremony for the Sydney Olympic Games that we both worked at, but didn't realize actually we were sitting 3 rows apart until 6 years later when we spotted each other in the same photo.
That's right. Absolutely. Very important event for me as well. I was a journalism student in Australia when the Sydney Olympics happened. So absolutely learned my craft in Sydney. And yes, we bonded over human nature. For those who may not know who Human Nature are, a very famous Australian boy band. And then we moved on to other important topics such as the Chicks and many other significant cultural moments. It was all about the Chicks when we met back in 2006.
It was very much about the Chicks, and that was a very, I think that was a very significant moment when the Chicks, formerly known as the Dixie Chicks, spoke out against some decisions that the President of the United States at the time had made. And watching that backlash against the Chicks from their core supporter base, which forced them to actually shift to a new supporter base, and it just happened to all be captured because they were recording a documentary at the time of their Top of the World tour while all of this unfolded, and that's now in a documentary, Shut Up and Sing. So I mean, without realizing, we were really analyzing pop culture and coverage then. And you might not know this, and I don't think you do know this about me, but I can really date my pop culture passion right back to even my year 12. So that that's final year at high school in Australia. The quote in my yearbook was, "Did anyone watch?" Because people said that all I did was talk about television, and then every day I'd come in and say, "Did anyone watch this? Did anyone watch that?" So that while everyone else had quite profound quotes in their Year 12 yearbook, I had, "Did anyone watch?"
That's a very interesting nugget of information, and I did not know that. So thank
There
you
we
for sharing
go.
that. Well, yes, and then really our conversations never really stopped. It's been 18 years of very interesting conversations from one end of the world to the other, because we live a long way apart, but we do connect very, very regularly, and so it made a whole lot of sense to actually bring this all together and have this moment. For our listeners, where we analyze from really bo different sides of the same fence, what we see in the pop culture world. So we talk about the moments, the people, the stories, what they tell us, and the way these stories are talked about in the media as well. And in today's episode, because now is the time it's happening, we're going to be talking about what the world's been obsessed with for years. And never more than in 2023, and that's Taylor Swift. And if early 2024 is any indication, there is no sign of people's interest waning in any way. We've got the next leg of the Eras Tour coming, a new album coming, and so much to talk about. So much to talk about from a media and communications perspective. So I guess the first question from me to you is really, where do you stand when it comes to Taylor Swift and her music? Because we're going to talk about, the narrative of Taylor Swift, and we decided to title this episode "Taylor Made: A New Era in Narrative and Media Discourse." So, how did Taylor Swift enter your universe, Georgie?
Look, I will be. It's going to take everything in me to stay quite measured when I talk about Taylor Swift because I am a very passionate Swiftie, very late to the party, I will admit. And you know, I first kind of look, oh, I will admit something horrifying that when Taylor first kind of hit the big time, particularly with Love Story, a friend of mine handed her CD to me and knowing my love of country music. And said, "I think you'll really like this person and this singer." And I listened to it. I went, "Oh, she's a bit pitchy and screechy." And then I just kind of wandered away from Taylor, which is mortifying when I think about it, particularly because I can't sing, so I don't know who I thought I was judging her singing. I then really took more of an interest in Taylor when a lot of friends took their children to see her concert, and I'm talking sort of. Probably 8 years ago, it was still an arena tour. And these friends of mine that went, so they would have been in their 40s when they took their children, said to me, "Oh my gosh." And I'm talking about friends that are very varied, you know, come from all walks of life. But the constant through them was, "Oh my gosh, her concert is amazing. She gives so much to her fans." And then the parents got on board as fans. And then I've probably gone on board maybe 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, properly. And then it has just built since then. And I think that actually talks to the power of Taylor that you can come in at any time in her career, and she's actually just collecting fans along the way. So I will. This is probably a signal of my passion for Taylor Swift that I am going to a Taylor Swift Experience tribute band tonight, and I'm thinking it's going to be pretty. Look, I'm expecting what you would probably expect from a tribute band, but that probably gives you a little bit of a taste of how passionate I am about Taylor as a Swiftie that has come onto the party a little bit later in life.
Had you ever been a fan of any other artist in the past, the way you're a fan of Taylor's today?
Yes, but probably not. That's a really good question. And I'm going to also be very transparent that I have just lived through a phase of Taylor and the phenomenon of Taylor coming to Australia for her series of concerts from the Eras Tour, of which I did not get tickets after about 15 hours of trying. So It's hard to actually to kind of view the passion for Taylor and take out the fact that for 15 hours over about six different ticket releases, I tried to get tickets and didn't. So that actually puts a different lens on it because there's a supply and demand issue with Taylor, which I haven't had with the other artists that I have been such fans of. So it actually creates a whole different experience as a fan.
I see what you mean, and it's very interesting because we've been lucky enough to work in the event world and to have had access to some things, to some shows, to some events. And I've got to say, trying to get tickets now for a concert can be a very taxing, almost traumatic experience because, you know, it's become sometimes very complicated, and for Taylor, probably more than for anyone else, to actually get tickets. And coming from the event world, obviously, when you work at an event, you have access to that event. Not that, I mean, your eyes on what you're supposed to do, but it's also a very interesting component because I've had the thought of, oh, am I going to get tickets for this concert? It looks like a hassle. I'm not going to do it. I can't be bothered. So it is now a full-on commitment to even get access to these events.
Exactly. And I was it, just as you brought that up, I was thinking back to other concerts that, I've been desperate to get tickets to, like Adele, like some smaller concerts. I went to one, a 100-person private concert with Sophie Ellis-Bextor 2 years ago that I was desperate to get to. But there was. It wasn't, well, the Sophie Ellis-Bextor one, I was worried I wasn't going to get tickets, but we did. The Adele one, it was kind of where were you going to get the tickets? Whereas maybe Taylor, when I look at it, is one of the first ones where, there is such a supply and demand issue that you actually, it's not about, oh gosh, I've got tickets in the back row. You actually can't get the tickets. And that brings a whole new, as I said, lens and experience, and as a fan, lays another layer over it. And so now you've actually got fans of Taylor Swift's in Melbourne, well, I'm sure across all the world, and you've kind of got the ones that went to the concert and then the ones that didn't, which obviously sounds quite simple, but they're two very different experiences of the phenomenon that, has just kind of swept through. So as a late Swiftie coming on, I have had other bands I'm passionate about. Probably I am far more defensive of Taylor probably than I have been of another artist that I have loved, but that's probably because I've not seen the coverage and the discussion around another artist the way that you see it around Taylor, which has probably forced me. Do you know that I was thinking the only other time I've been very defensive about a pop culture thing is when Beverly Hills 90210 came out, and they were always the same year as me. So when they were in, final year of high school, I was in final year of high school. When they were first year college, I was first year uni. And I remember sitting in the cafeteria at uni and someone, really bagging out the show and actually said, "Can you stop? They're my friends you're talking about." And I felt a real defensiveness to, stop dissing this show that I actually think is really good and does. I mean, I don't live in Beverly Hills, but you have the same issues that any kid has growing up and going through, sort of that coming of age. So that's probably the only other time I have felt very defensive, like I do with Taylor. But that's me. Where did you discover Taylor?
Oh, wow. So Taylor Swift for me, it was kind of a backdoor thing of I knew who Taylor Swift was, obviously, because I have always been obsessed with MTV. I grew up watching MTV when I was a kid in the States, and then was always, well, one thing you may not know about me is that my master's thesis at university was about the media discourse of MTV. So
I did not
yes.
know that nugget.
So I did study the topic in detail. And so obviously MTV back in the day, the awards shows were so big. We'll talk about the awards shows one of these days, Georgie. But
We
yes, the
will,
awards shows
my
of
passion for the journey of awards shows.
That's right. So I remember what happened at the MTV Video Music Awards with the Kanye West situation. And when I realized that Taylor Swift had a fandom and people were interested in her was when I was teaching in high school 11 years ago. I was teaching in high school, and at the end of a class one day, two of my students, two 15-year-olds, came to me and asked me, what does you belong with me mean? I was an English teacher, obviously in France, so I explained to them what it meant, obviously different than you belong to me and this belongs to me. So I explained to them, and then at the end of my explanation, I said, are you asking me about the Taylor Swift song? And they were. And I thought to myself, and it, I actually had a moment where I thought, this is it. These are the fans of Taylor Swift. Country music has never been a thing in France. I mean, except for probably Shania Twain, you know, at the turn of the century. But it was never a thing. And to see that Taylor Swift had fans made me all the more interested in the dynamic. France has never been a major market for Taylor Swift. It never was until maybe a couple of years ago. France is one of the five biggest markets in the world when it comes to music, with Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And at one point when 1989 came out, I think it was between Red and 1989, there was this kind of conversation in the media that Taylor Swift was interested in working on the French market more to kind of be a little more established in France because she wasn't. Her record sales, but also France leaves very little room to international artists now. It is predominantly a French language market. Most of the music people listen to is French language music. And I actually had a, I thought to myself, is she even going to sell out the shows in France? Because she's performing at my hometown stadium in Lyon for 2 nights. The capacity, I think, is around 60,000 people. And she sold out within hours, like, you know, she did everywhere else in the world. And only one third of the people coming to those shows are actually coming from overseas. I thought it was going to be a tidal wave of people from Italy and Switzerland and the neighboring countries, but not really. Just to bring it back to my relationship with Taylor's music and the narrative, I bought my first Taylor Swift record 2 years ago, only because it was on sale. So I was never a fan. I still am not. I'm indifferent at most. I am interested in her presence and her popularity, but I'm not a huge fan of her. I mean, and I was, I mean, I've been a fan. The way I think you react to anything that has to do with Taylor, I probably had with Madonna, with Kylie Minogue. So, you know, we'll talk about those two together one day, but absolutely. So I don't think there was enough room left for me to take in kind of the whole dimension of Taylor Swift in my hard drive. You know what I mean?
I do, because I think more than any other artist, and obviously we're talking in a time of social media, of easy access, you know, when I say easy access to these artists. They're more accessible to us than ever before, most of them, because of social media, because of 24-hour news cycles. You know, we're not waiting for a newspaper to come out the next day with photos of her. We're getting them instantly when they're uploaded. So
That's right.
I do think it's very different to view Taylor Swift than to view Madonna when she first hit the big time. You know, to view the Beatles when they first hit the big time. And you know, I think about my mum and my aunt. Went to the Beatles shows when they came to Australia. Australia was very lucky to sign up the Beatles just before they hit the big time. So the Beatles
Right.
actually came to Australia on, you know, the cheapest contract I think there was, but they honored it. They played for 20 minutes. When you think Taylor plays for nearly 4 hours, the Beatles played for something like 22 minutes. My mum says she didn't, you know, she said she wasn't going to cry, but she did cry. So, and my aunt went and saw the Beatles when they came out on the balcony at, you know, one of the major venues in Melbourne, and it was just a crowd of people. But you could only get access to someone like the Beatles either through watching them on print, on news, on cinema, in those fleeting moments. So it's a completely different fan engagement that we're talking about now, which doesn't diminish Taylor's success, or I'm not comparing her to others, but it is interesting to view and see how those other factors actually impact her strategy and her fan engagement, and how people like myself can come on at any time. And it's interesting because people often say to me, "What are your favorite Taylor albums?" And because I've never kind of come in at a certain time, I've actually just kind of eased into being a Swiftie. I don't have key albums. I actually have key songs and key moments. And it's it was kind of the medley she did at a music awards not long after sort of all the issues with the rights to her songs came out, that kind of got me hooked. It was like a little taste plate, a little sort of tapas of Taylor, and I could easily access, oh, okay, I like that song, I like that song, I'll dive deeper in. And then it's just kind of grown from there.
That's very interesting what you raise. I mean, I'm still thinking about having seen the Beatles. That's, I mean, such a moment to be able to like throw that into a conversation and say, "Oh, I saw
Yeah,
them when I
sorry,
came to
just drop that.
Australia."
Yeah, I'll just drop that
You
there.
know, I don't know if you know this about me, but I do that whenever someone tells me they're the biggest fan of Friends that there is. I'll wait for the end of the conversation and then say, "I went to the live taping of an episode of
Just
Friends." So,
got to get them one up, don't you?
that, well,
Sometimes you
you
just
can't.
have to let people know, okay, well, let me just show you how much of a fan
I
I
know. Well, it
am.
no, it's more about them trying to tell me that they're a bigger fan than me, but
Correct.
that, you know, we'll get into that
Exactly.
at some. But
Exactly.
you raise a good point with what you've just said, and I was interested also in talking about today, the, let's say, why we think Taylor Swift is so popular, because we have spoken about this in the past. And obviously, whether you like her or not, there are some objective elements where you can just stand and look at the phenomenon and think, this is why Taylor Swift is so popular. And we'll talk about the concepts that I wanted to raise, which are the text, the subtext, and the context in a minute.
Yes.
But you certainly have ideas about
Oh,
why
I have
Taylor Swift has
ideas.
been so popular and opinions.
Not like me to have an opinion. But you know what? It's just going back to your comment about friends and, when people try and say they're a fan. I found myself doing that mindset with Taylor. Like, I mean, I considered going out to the airport at 1 a.m. to watch her plane land. So then you get into this kind of psyche of, well, I'm a dedicated fan. I was going to go and see her plane land, and here's someone going to a concert who, doesn't even know her songs. Why do they get to go to a concert and I don't? And you start to have these internal kind of, but I'm a bigger fan, so I deserve this, which I don't know I have had with other people. Maybe I have and I've forgotten. But it is interesting because I think when you look at Taylor, there's Taylor, I think there's almost three elements to look at. There's Taylor as a songwriter and an artist. There's Taylor as a marketing genius. I'm going to call her and her team a marketing genius, and we'll talk about that fan engagement. But then there's the phenomenon, which is driven by the media. So there's actually three segments that you can look at when you talk about Taylor. It doesn't all come in one. I think you sort of look at those. I
Let's divide
think
and conquer then.
let's divide and conquer. And I'm not going to touch on her singing because I know people have various views. I think anyone who can sing for 4 hours live at a concert and dance can sing. Her songwriting, I think, is, I mean, apart from the fact the volume of songs that this person, I don't want to say churns out, because that sounds like it's that she doesn't put the time and effort into it, but the volume and her work ethic and her capacity to write so many songs and really personal songs. And when I say personal songs, obviously personal to her, and I think this ties in with the fan engagement, is that we're on the journey with her. She's bringing us in on her story. So not only do we have some background about these songs that she's writing because we've seen what's been going on in the media, it's the way she also pushes back in her songs, and we'll talk about that probably when we talk about our favorite songs. And I was watching a podcast recently where one of the hosts was talking about going to a Taylor Swift concert and apologizing to his wife live at the concert, saying, "Oh, I get it now." And I thought it was really interesting because between the two hosts, and they were male hosts and clearly had not been Taylor fans and would not come from a genre of Taylor Swift music, and apologies because I can't recall their names, but they hit the nail on the head. One of them said, Taylor's not singing her songs, she's singing their songs. You know, she says the things to her exes, I wish I said to my ex. This is what they're saying, they're her fans feel. You know, she leaves the guys that aren't good for her, and I wish I had left them. You know, she's standing up to the patriarchy when I can't stand up to the patriarchy. So she embodies so much that we can relate to. I do believe more than any other artist. And certainly other artists, you know, have very personal songs that you resonate with. I think Taylor has, apart from the, you know, she creates great melodies and tunes, she does more than any other artist, I believe. The volume of personal songs that she writes that we can relate to, that aren't necessarily kind of aspirational and out of our reach and singing about things, you know, that we can't actually access. She's singing things that we can resonate with, whether we're an older person like myself in your late 40s, or you're a teen that's, you know, going through the coming of age at high school and uni, or you're a primary school student who just likes the, you know, melodies and the tunes. There's something that we can all relate to. So that's the songwriting. On her as a marketing machine, and I'll call her that because I do think we need to look at the way her and her team market is unbelievable. And if it was a brand like Nike or Apple or one of those, we would, you know, there'd be case studies around it. You know, people would study her in marketing course, study those brands in marketing courses. I don't understand why there isn't that. Well, there is, and we'll talk about the
There
Swift
probably
podium.
is.
There would be, and there should be, because, you know, what she does is she creates a community, and it's a very inclusive community. You can come in, you don't have to be you know, the most fashionable person. You don't have to be the most cutting edge person. You can just be you, and you can be a Taylor fan. Now, obviously, you can do that with, you know, most artists, but there are subcultures within artists, and I think Taylor's is a very inclusive one. That's how I feel. Her fan engagement, and she kind of, you know, goes by that number one rule of nurture your existing fans, members, customers before trying to recruit new. She looks after you as a fan. You know, she gives you sneak peeks at things. She drops little hints. She plants those Easter eggs. You know, if we look
She
back
bakes
to,
cookies.
she bakes cookies. She has private concerts at her home. Now, in reality, how many million fans are there around the world? We're not actually going to get access to those, but we feel like we're going to get access. She
And we know
releases,
they exist.
we know they exist. She releases a recording of her tour while it's still happening. Now, of course, you know, there's a million pop concerts that have come out on DVD in the old days and things like that, but she makes it feel like she's doing it for us. You know, and I'm not saying that this isn't all about making sales, but it is done in such a clever way. And she makes us feel part of her. And, you know, I know we've discussed this, and I'd love to, you know, do a real study looking at Barack Obama's presidential campaign for his first term, which was applauded for the way this fairly new politician on the block garnered grassroots support through social media, through text campaigns. You know, they went really back to basics in a very new strategy that hadn't been done like that on a political campaign. And I would be very interested to compare that to the way Taylor builds her fan engagement, because I think there is real genius in the way she gives enough that we're interested, but doesn't give too much that we're bombarded. She plants that seed that we want to know more, that we feel like we're part of her, because it is a fine line between feeling like she's giving us little, you know, album drops and song drops without feeling like, oh, she's selling to me again. And I was listening to a podcast where they talked about, it was two people had been to her concert, and they talked about the fact she promoted an upcoming thing that was going to be for sale. And one of the hosts felt it was, you know, hang on, we've bought the ticket to come. Don't then upsell us while we're here. Whereas the other host felt, no, she's rewarding us for coming by giving us this sneak peek. So even amongst fans, there's, you know,
Yes.
different opinions of how her quite, you know, capitalist marketing strategy does roll out.
And you raise a very, very good point with because anything that everything and anything that you've just said in the past few minutes from a different point of view, it could be kind of flipped and turned around. But before I get into that, I wanted to ask you, because you were talking about direct engagement with the fans. Do you remember when we were in Doha before we actually left Qatar? We got a message, a text message. Do you remember from whom?
No, I don't.
We got a text message from Sean Paul. Do you remember
Right.
Sean Paul?
No.
The artist that did all those collaborations with Beyoncé and everything?
Yes.
Well, you don't remember the text message though. We got
No.
a text message because Sean Paul was performing in Doha, and we all got a direct text message saying, "Hi, this is Sean Paul. I'm coming to, whatever venue were there at that time." And we didn't go because I think it was happening after we would have left or something. But I
Yes.
did want to bring that little memory back to you. So
But that's very, yeah, gosh, how bad's my memory? That's really interesting, though, isn't it? Because certainly during political campaigns, and we know how it works, they just, the program sends out and just sends to every configuration of a mobile number. So it's not that they have your mobile number, they're just trying every mobile number combination. And when it happens in Australia, and it's usually around political campaigns or plebiscites or referendums where people are trying to get a point to you, it doesn't go down well in Australia. I didn't ask to be contacted. How did you get my mobile number? Even though we know how it works now. So don't come to me if I haven't asked you to. But if I've become a fan or if you've welcomed me in, then I'm okay to receive that. But it's interesting, isn't it? How would have I felt if I'd got a text from Taylor Swift when she arrived in Melbourne, knowing I didn't have a ticket to her concert? I'm not sure how I would have received that.
I
Yeah.
mean, let's be honest, I think, and we'll probably talk about this because I lived in Dubai for a while, and I'm very also interested in the perspective that, you would get in the Middle East on culture from all around the world. And that's a very interesting topic that we can raise at a later point. But to go back to the point that you were making about, see, I see things from a different point of view. And my take on the text, subtext, context dynamic here is that, Taylor's been around for, is it 16 years now or something like that?
Yes.
She's been around for 16 years. And I feel that her uninterrupted storytelling, because she's been very prolific, I think that her uninterrupted storytelling has been very linear. There's been a very horizontal evolution. So both in narrative, because there's this very heavy component, and I don't mean heavy as in annoying, I mean heavy as in, constant. This very important element of Alice in Wonderland and a sense of wonderment at discovering life, what life is about. And then if you throw in her cats as characters in that dynamic, you're there. You're in Alice in Wonderland. So she's been around for 16 years, and this evolution, I feel, has been very horizontal. Also, in terms of the character that she hasn't changed much in the past 16 years. And I'm not saying this is good or bad, but so many other artists her age, and I don't like to talk about age, but who have had the number of years of career that she's had, a lot of them go through what we call emancipations or kind of, different phases and makeovers and things like that. If you think about Miley Cyrus, or in the 90s, if you think about Mariah Carey, who actually had an album that was called The Emancipation of Mimi. So that's, I feel that it's been very, there's a very reassuring component in the narrative of Taylor Swift in terms of how that's been rolled out through the years. But then also, I'm thinking she's been around for 16 years. How long is she going to be able to sustain the narrative that she's been rolling out, particularly because we're nearing the end of the rollout of the Taylor's Versions album. So those were also kind of, there were very important elements of the narrative in terms of, gaining the symbolic ownership of everything she'd put out so far. So, and I think that I like the component that I'll give you that I find interesting is the absence of divide between herself and her fans. I remember a television show she was on morning television in the States when she turned to whoever journalist was interviewing her, and instead of saying thank, I mean, she said thank you for doing this for us in terms of the fans and herself as one, entity that you cannot break down.
Yes, and that's such an interesting point. And I remember someone told me years ago. Now, this is very anecdotal. I have no footnotes, no bibliography for where this comment came from. But they were talking about the Hillary Clinton campaign when she ran for president, and I think the slogan was "I'm with her." Something like
That's
that.
right.
And they said that research had found the result could have been quite different if her slogan had been, she's with us. So I think it is really, and that plays back to that Taylor thanking us. She brings us on the journey. And it's interesting, you were talking about her journey and it's, and this Alice in Wonderland. And it's, I don't actually view her anywhere like that. And I remember. I'll go back to a conversation we had last year, but I actually view her, and maybe because I have come on a little bit later, I see her as a very strong businesswoman, a very strong artist who is pushing back against a music industry that is so restrictive and has such control over artists. And to the point where she's actually informing us as fans of what's going on that we didn't know about. She's pushing back to the media and calling journalists out on the way they report on her as a woman. And I remember talking to you on one of our WhatsApp discussions last year about artists, and you were talking about your feelings on Taylor, and you said, "I don't know, I think I like artists with a bit more edge." And I remember where I was walking, I was in Sydney and I was walking along the harbour listening to that message from you. And I was like, edge, edge, how can you can't get more edgy than a person that is challenging the media commentary and discourse on her, that's challenging the music industry. So on stage, she might not have that edge, but I actually think that's a strength of hers because she's basically saying, as a woman, you don't have to, or a girl, you don't have to be sexy, you don't have to be edgy, you don't have to be controversial, you can actually just be. And even I think when you were talking about her cat, as a woman, you always hear about, oh, if you're older and you're single, you become the cat lady and you have 40 cats, and it's this, of course, it's never said
She
about
made
men.
that cool.
She
She
made
made
it
that cool.
cool. It's cooler to be a dog person than a cat person. It is what kind of, I don't think that, but the commentary is often around that, you don't hear about, a guy that's older and single never gets called the cat man, he's the stud or the silver fox or something. So she's actually, there's so many elements you could actually read into the things that she has just made cats cool, and she doesn't care. Well, it comes across that she doesn't care. Of course she cares because we hear it in some of her songs, but she is pushing back. So I actually think her emancipation is not changing her music, although of course she had the Reputation album. I think it is the way she pushes back on interviews and the way that the media view her and the media, and then as a woman, and I don't want to bring gender, but I will, I feel like she's pushing back for all of us in the way she's reported on. And I know there's an interview, I think it's with Hoda, where she says, I'm just really concerned for you because you write songs about your exes. And I'm just very concerned for you that, no one will want to date you if this is how you act. And Taylor just sort of, and she's quite young in this interview, she sort of sits back, she takes a breath, and she says, "Well, I guess the thing is, don't treat me badly, and I won't write a bad song about you."
I mean, there's so much to be said about interviewing styles, and we'll probably get to that at a later point in one of our shows to talk about how
Exactly.
interviews are conducted.
That's right. But what Taylor is calling out, and she says this in an interview, is that, for a long period of time, we have With the pay, and I don't want to get really sort of patriarchal and patriarchy in this interview, but we have put up with a certain amount of treatment as women in media, in pop culture, in how we're viewed. When we start to push back, and she's right, I think she's absolutely correct on this. What is being reported on is our reaction, not the bad behavior that we're reacting to. And so, why is there not coverage of the way she's been treated badly by these boyfriends instead of the way she's reacting? So I think there's a whole range of ways she's challenging, and I can see you shaking
No,
your
I don't agree with
head.
that last bit of why would we need. I mean, we can talk about, yeah, no, I see what you mean in terms of media coverage.
But it's that it's
Yes.
the coverage is of the reaction instead of the behavior that the reaction
Well, because
is
she's
happening to.
writing about, well, because she's writing about it, so the people are going to ask the questions to her. And not gonna go, they're not, and this is all, it's neither confirm nor deny.
Of
So
course.
there's this air of mystery about all these songs. And I think that's, you raise a very interesting point about subtext, because the subtext is aimed directly at her audience through, you know, where you were talking about Easter eggs and everything. But
Yes.
interpretation, she's never come out and actually said this song is about that person, and that song is about this person. So if you think about it, I think it's also one of the elements that has really kept the interest going. And I think it's also part of the marketing strategy to get the interest of the media going as well. And I think that her lyrics, and I'm just going to flip the narrative because you were talking about lyrics that are relatable. I think that the lyrics are generic and generic enough that they appear universal and could mean something to anyone or could be changed depending on, you know, the situation and the context. Context is a very important one as well, because if you think about Karma, one of the songs from her album Midnights, she changed the lyrics to kind of have a sentence about Travis Kelce. Karma is the guy on the Chiefs coming straight home to me. So if she can do it, it means she can give the audience permission also to change those lyrics around. If you
Yes.
think about a song like I Kissed a Girl by Katy Perry, because it's my reference as a kind of counter example. You know, what else can you, what can you interpret about that song? Because it is so explicit
Yes.
and it's so out there, you know? So just a couple more things I wanted to say about this is, I find very interesting. I think there's, but every artist has done that. I think there's a formula to the Taylor Swift album, particularly if you think about from Red to, let's say, 1980, or no, not even Reputation, you know, start with a very kind of gimmicky song, like
Yes.
the first single out is going to be
Yep.
that we're never ever getting back together, and then Shake It Off, and then what was the next one? You know, Look What You Made Me Do, for
Yes.
example. So I th that's very gimmicky, and there's a formula of kind of launching the album out into the world. And then
Yes.
there's always the song that comes after, if you think about Blank Space, The Man, You Need to Calm Down, all those where she pulls in the criticism that she's facing and flips it. So, you know, she addresses it in her song when she says, "It's me, hi, I'm the problem, it's me." You know,
Yes.
and she's not the first one to have done that. We've spoken about this, you and
Yes.
I. You know, if you think about Survivor that Beyoncé wrote when she was still
Yes.
part of Destiny's Child, you know, it's a, also a there. And Beyoncé did the same when she faced some backlash and came out with some merch that said boycott Beyoncé. You know, she literally flipped the narrative. So I think it's very interesting how she's been able to include all those components. But one thing we haven't spoken about, and I'll wrap up with that for this part,
Yes.
is that it seems that Taylor Swift, as far as I'm concerned, you were talking about marketing, and her marketing is
Yes.
incredibly smart, but she doesn't have any direct competition anymore. I don't think she has any direct competition anymore because all the other singers are much less prolific than, and not taking anything away from her own talent. But it's, remember the period where it was Madonna, Janet Jackson, Mariah Carey, Whitney
Yes.
Houston,
Yes.
Celine Dion, all together
Yes.
releasing stuff all together at once. She doesn't have that. Katy Perry is doing American Idol. You
Yes.
know, Adele's only releasing an album every 5 years.
Yes.
There's no competition. So she's got this boulevard of, you know, bringing more people in as she She
He
dishes out the
does.
music.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And I went to a Swift Symposium recently, which was held jointly by two universities in Melbourne around Taylor Swift. And that came up on the panel discussion that I saw, and there was a comment made that people can't get in because she's got this monopoly on the music. And there's so many questions that throws up because the first one I'll just address is, okay, you want us to be successful, but don't be too successful. So be successful enough, but don't be too successful that you don't let others in. I mean, it's that kind of speech in Barbie. Be this, but don't be too
Absolutely.
much of that. I'm not sure I agree with that. I do agree that those eras of lots of artists, like you were saying, those Madonna, Whitney Houston, all of those, we don't have that at the moment. But I wonder if that's less to do with Taylor and more to do with the fact that, we now get access to, or, anyone can kind of become a recording artist. They can do it independently. They can come out on YouTube. If we look
Of
at people
course.
like Teddy Swims, I mean, even Justin Bieber started on YouTube. So there's a lot more platforms for people. So maybe our tastes are kind of more diversified because we don't have these concentrated musicians through the traditional music industry, labels and channels.
Well, because labels were really kind of, and we're talking about formula, but if you look at Mariah Carey's albums in the 90s, and if you look at Celine Dion's album, it was the Sony Music formula of that time.
Exactly.
Power ballads, a couple of up-tempo songs. It was the same thing applied to every major artist. And Tommy Mottola from Sony Music tried to pull in every single powerhouse singer, Tina
Yes.
Arena included, to kind of, bring them into that formula and dish out the records that way. For some,
And
it worked wonders. For some, it doesn't. It didn't.
listener, I'm just going to let you know that we're going to have a money jar for every time Vicken mentions Tina Arena, and that's the first dollar going in the
That's the first
jar.
time. I'll
I
need to get a jar and I'll need to get some dollar bills.
think you'll
But
need a
yes,
wheelbarrow
definitely.
for the amount of mentions. But you're right. I mean, you look at Stock Aitken and Waterman. I mean, they
Oh,
had a
yeah.
formula.
That's
But
right.
with Taylor Swift coming back to that, her formula of albums, there's two things there. She's never saying, I'm a groundbreaking artist. She's just an artist recording songs. But it also means you don't have to be a groundbreaking artist to engage with people. And I really liked your comment about her songs are so general, anyone can access them. Maybe that's the genius. They're so general that anyone can find themselves in them, and then they actually become personal.
That's right.
But with regards to the competition, I do hear what you're saying around, I guess it's like a tennis player. When you've got, say, Serena Williams at the top of her game, there's no one else there. But do we, that's not Serena's fault.
Absolutely.
But would I don't know whether I mean this is all obviously hypothetical, but I think there is room for more artists. I think there is room for us to have other, because really at the moment it's Taylor and Beyonce. If we look at female recording artists, as you said, we've got Rihanna off doing her makeup and
Business.
her business and her retail lines. We've got Adele with her residency at Las Vegas, not really bringing out albums. But I do think there would be room. I don't think you're a Swiftie and you can't diversify your music interests to someone else. They might not get the loyalty that Taylor has built up, but I think
That's right.
a Swiftie does like other music.
No, and I absolutely get that. I think what is also very engaging is we were talking about text, subtext, and context, and they all go together. But in this case, there is much more porosity between all three, and then you have, the Swifties who are spending a lot of times using the context to interpret the subtext of the text.
Yes.
So, and of course, that has to do with the way in which the lyrics are actually brought out into those songs. And I think you were talking about announcing new releases and everything. I found that very interesting that for her last two albums, she announced them at a moment where she was getting rewarded, receiving an award. So it's also this thing of I'm getting honored, I'm getting awarded, I'm getting rewarded. So in return, I'm giving you, my fans, something. She announced Midnights at the MTV Video Music Awards after she won Video of the Year, and then announced her upcoming album at the Grammys when she won for Pop Album. So I think that's also very interesting. And I think we're talking about kind of keeping the audience engaged. And you've raised something about this, I think, when it came to the Taylor's versions of the album, something about the DVD with commentary coming out, you know, when you already have the initial cut of the film, right?
That's
I
right.
think,
Yeah, we were
yeah.
talking, yes, you and I were talking earlier about, and I think the fact she's doing Taylor's versions is, I mean, there's a whole podcast just in that. And I think what has been another piece of genius is that she's not just rushing out Taylor's version albums. She's interspersing them with new albums.
That's right.
So we're not going to get to the end of this batch and then sort of go, oh, do we even want new music? Because you've kind of bombarded us with this. She's actually keeping us interested. And of course, she announced the Poets album when everyone thought she was going to announce it. One of the Taylor's versions. But it is interesting because now you feel it's even more personal. So we were talking about sort of movies, and particularly key movies in the 80s where you'd have the director's cut. And it was always because there was a little bit of, friction between the producer and the director, and the director was never happy with what was distributed. So you'd have the director's cut. And with Taylor, we know this is because of the issue with her. Well, I mean, issue is such a soft word, but because of what's happened to her ownership over the songs. So you get these Taylor's versions, which you feel like she's giving you just for you.
Right.
And we could do a whole nother podcast on actually how the recording of Taylor's version albums and how it impacts actually the songs because they've
We
now been,
might.
we might, because they're being recorded during a time that she's not going through the issues or the the situations that those songs reference. So how do you bring that
Adding
emotion back?
layers
How do you bring
again, adding
correct?
layers to the narrative. And if you think of the parallel that I kind of was thinking about when I was thinking about all this is, you know, the Disney movie, because back in the day, a Disney movie would be, you know, launched and then pulled, they would pull out all the cassettes, the video cassettes and DVDs, and then take them off the market and then re-release everything 7 years later, which is what Disney felt was a new generation of viewers. So if you think of a Disney movie, Taylor Swift is the main character. So she's the book, she's the soundtrack, she's the merch, so the toys, she's the movie adaptation of that particular story. She's the extended version, and she's the DVD with commentary with the Taylor's versions. Because there's the extended narrative and there's the added layer of interpretation to that extended narrative. And then she's the tour. So she ticks every box the way a Disney movie used to do. So I found that also very interesting.
And tell me, do you think that we would be having these conversations if Taylor was a band? Like, I do
Oh,
think because she writes the songs and it's one performer up there, even though she's got an amazing band and we know the loyalty of that band. I think one of her guitarists has been there from the start, of the journey 15, 16 years ago. I just wonder, would we be having this conversation about U2 or Coldplay or the Rolling Stones and their, or, in the UK, Oasis, their dominance? Does it feel because it's this one person that feels obviously she has a massive team behind it, but because she writes her songs and because she's leading so much of it, do you think we would have this conversation if it was a band as opposed to a single recording artist?
What part of the conversation are you referring to? About the
Around,
dominance and
yes,
the.
and the brand and the like the parallels with Disney, because you say, she's the star, she's the DVD, she's the director's cut, she's the commentary. Would we, I don't know, I just wonder, would we have this conversation? And I'm not even just talking about Taylor, like if we talk about Madonna or Beyonce, would we have those conversations, or Ed Sheeran, would we have those conversations if it was a band where somehow we feel like, oh, well, there's a few of them, so they, this is justified, as opposed to how can this one person be doing everything?
Well, until, to be fully honest with you, until Beyonce and Taylor Swift came along, I think the only person that was ever compared to a band is Madonna, because Madonna defined, because you were talking about tours, Madonna with the Blonde Ambition tour of 1990 defined the concept of touring narrative. And that, that's, and I was watching an interview with of Pink. I saw a snippet pop up as I was, scrolling down my phone, and I saw an interview of Pink kind of saying again, and many artists have said it before her, of, Madonna's paved the way, because she was being asked about Madonna's, again, her age or something. And she was like, what I should be asked about is how she's really paved the way for everyone that's come after her. And I mean, and I'm not saying that because I'm a Madonna fan. Because I'm saying that because it is commonly understood that, the Blonde Ambition tour was a turning point in the way tours were done. But
And
now
I
Beyonce and Taylor Swift have reached that level.
Yes, and I would have agreed with you, but what I found interesting in the Swiftposium is one of the academics talking about that the arena tour and the tour with a narrative concept has always been led by women. But she actually dates it further back to recording artists like Kate Bush. Who actually have, and not saying Kate Bush did arena tours like Madonna, but they actually introduced this concept of that storytelling in a concert. And she actually referenced the fact of, so many female artist tours have the bride character in the tour. They have the good girl, bad girl character in the tour, and it's very much a diva, and I mean that not in a negative way, I mean that in a very empowering way, sort of that diva legacy of these female artists that you don't get. And I'm trying to think of any solo male artists that do have a narrative in their concerts, like
No, they
Madonna
don't.
does, like Beyonce does, like Taylor does, like Kate Bush, before her, they don't. But I just wonder when we talk about Taylor or Madonna, because they are single people, it becomes very personal almost in a negative way. Whereas I think if we were talking about U2 as a band, it's not, and obviously, Bono being the lead singer, but it's not, yeah, I just wonder whether the commentary would be slightly different if it was a band. But speaking of commentary, obviously, there's a lot of media coverage of Taylor, and I'm really interested to hear your opinions as a journalist, watching what your fellow journalists are report, what they're reporting on, how they're reporting around Taylor, particularly in the last, sort of really 6 months, 12 months.
I mean, how much time have you got? I mean, for me, I've always, as a journalist, been able to differentiate and dissociate the work of a single journalist as a person trying to do their job the best they can, and when, the media get carried away over covering something, because it's all about, it only takes the one outlet to kind of break a story, and then everyone wants in on that story. And the only time I've actually felt, a coverage being carried away the ways in which I see it for Taylor Swift sometimes, as a working journalist myself, when I took a step back and said, this is too much, like we're doing too much about this, was for a pandemic, when we had the avian flu pandemic in France, and everyone was, trying to get as many stories as they could. And then when we take a step back, we were like, oh, maybe we did a, you know, we did we we went a bit too far with this one. But I think for any kind of situation, it's very easy to get carried away, much easier to get carried away than to kind of really go swim against the tide, really, because, it's very difficult to keep your cool when it's taking place. And I think also with Taylor Swift, what's been very interesting is obviously her relationship with Travis Kelce, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But it's been very interesting because it wasn't Travis Kelce plus Taylor Swift. It was Travis Kelce times Taylor Swift, and it became this gigantic thing. And for people who are not aware, because I live in the States, so I can tell, because I became familiar with Taylor Swift, with Travis Kelce, sorry, last year when he won his first Super Bowl and he hosted Saturday Night Live. So he was already very much an established figure in pop culture. And when, their relationship was made public, it became even more massive, for both of them to be together. But I think there were a couple of instances where I thought this is too much. For example, the New York Times publishing an article about, is she going to be able to get to Vegas on time to be at the Super Bowl? And I thought, I'm a subscriber of the New York Times. I've always kind of had this compass in my head when I was a journalist, thinking if it's interesting to me, it will be interesting to other people. But you think about these stories, when you try to break something that not everyone knows. But this was overreported on anyway, and I felt I came this close to ending my subscription, because I was like, I don't need this in my life. This is too much, So I think what is interesting, just one last thing is the line of report. When you're talking about a newsroom and a news outlet, the line of reporting usually dictates coverage, but here, coverage dictates the line of reporting, meaning that Taylor Swift herself is a line of reporting, because you do have today newsrooms that have hired a journalist whose sole work is to cover Taylor Swift. So that person needs to break the stories and find the stories. And then, it's a never-ending kind of machine that feeds itself. So,
So I'm interested, put us in the psyche of a chief of staff or a newsroom at a publication. And of course we can say newspaper, but it's all online. So it's tw these 24-hour news cycles, which, as we've talked about, completely change the way we take in our news and our appetite and our instant, we want instant news now. Put us in the psyche of you're in the newsroom, you're chief of staff. How do you make those decisions on, okay, we're going to run an article on whether Taylor's plane can get back from Japan in time for the Super Bowl? And whether you run that, are you doing it based on demand? Are you doing it because, it will bring readers that maybe you haven't previously engaged with to your newspaper? What would be the process around making those editorial decisions of those articles that they're running?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things, but I think it's also a combination of, are we the most legitimate media outlet to be talking about that specific kind of aspect? I think it's more about thinking about your integrity, and I'm all for expanding the line of, I mean, most of the journalistic work that I've done, apart from covering stories as they come to you, is, try and bring a different perspective or try and expand the line of reporting in terms of the topics that you bring to the readership of one particular outlet. I think what is very interesting is it's a combination of, are you the most legitimate an outlet to talk about a certain topic, and at the same time, what can be does the positive, how do you balance the positive and the negative impact? I think there is a lot of people who are on, Taylor Swift overload, to be fully honest, because I read a lot of the news and a lot of the comments, and if you go on the, chat, in the chat rooms and the comment boards and everything, you see that there is, a lot of people. But at the same time, swimming against the tide sometimes is hard. And, if you throw in, that was it the who was it the embassy, the Japanese embassy? I think one Japanese organization came out with their own take on whether Taylor was going to be able to make it to Vegas, considering the time differences and the time
Right.
zones and everything. I don't exactly remember what it was, but when you
Yes.
have credible, I mean, is it the role of an embassy to, when Kim Kardashian was going to release her brand of clothing, form-fitting undergarments, I don't even know what you call them. The mayor of was it Kobe in Japan actually wrote a letter to say you can't use kimono because kimono kind of means a lot to us in terms of Japanese culture, and then she decided to rename her brand Skims. That, I guess, is the role of an organization to kind of protect
Yes.
its cultural heritage. Is it the role of an embassy or a government to come out and say, oh, yes, Taylor can make it? You know what I mean? I'm questioning
Yes.
myself because.
Yes, and that probably leads into my next question. I think in the role of the way social media is now, we know those that personality that they're trying to bring in. We see it with the London Tube is a really good example of when they had the intern or the work experience person was putting stuff out on the social media and it was really funny and it was whether it was orchestrated or not. You see particularly like police forces can actually sometimes put out really funny posts like we're looking for the goals of the team that didn't score any in the match sort of thing. So, I think social media has brought in banter that you wouldn't usually have an office like an embassy bringing out something like that. But they go, oh, how can we actually make, how can we get personality out of this? How can we be cheeky? How can we be
Do
clever?
we
So,
need to be cheeky, though? Do we need to bring personality? I read an article yesterday on Billboard. They were reporting on a decision that was a court decision on
yes.
Metallica trying to get insurance money for all the shows that were canceled at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. In the decision, in the court's decision, the justice quoted a Taylor Swift song.
Yes.
And is it where d is it the right place to do that? Do we need that? Is my
Absolutely.
question.
And I think it comes down to, well, what's the purpose? Is the embassy trying to engage young people to understand how to get a visa? I don't know. Then maybe that is. Like you've got to go back to those core, what's your core purpose and objective?
That's right. And you
And
have to
is
do
this
that as a media
delivering
organization as well.
correct? Are you delivering on that, or are you just getting caught up in the hype and thinking, oh, we can be fun on social media? Everyone says, oh, we need a, an Instagram account or a Facebook. And I work with clients that say that, and my first thing is, why? Like who's going to follow you on Facebook? And what content are you going to put out that is of interest? So it's not just, so you've got to kind of always tie it back to the strategy. And okay, so maybe that tweet or X, whatever we call them now, or that post got huge engagement. But where does that lead? Like, is that just a blip on their, engagement analytics? And it's from people that have nothing to do with needing to use the Japanese embassy, or a
That's
Japan
right.
trying to look like they're really welcoming her and they're on board with Taylor Swift. So it's always got to come back to the strategy. And when you were talking about the journalism and those decisions that are made, and I wonder whether this is I'm putting a big question out there, and I know we don't have much time left, but is the reporting on the on Taylor Swift and the Taylor Swift phenomenon actually an example of how journalism has changed? We know media outlets don't make the money they used to because things are online. We know that the numbers of journalists and reporters are cut. We know there's a whole new set of journalists that haven't come through those traditional journalism training grounds, that anyone can be a reporter and covering news because of social media. So is this reporting and these perhaps lapses in judgment around what people are report, is it actually a symptom of a wider issue with the media?
I don't know, because to be fully honest with you, I think, when a journalist comes into the newsroom, You bring in your own experience and your own take and the stories that you want to write. And I know that every publication that I've left, and I'm not saying anyone's irreplaceable, but I never saw the kinds of stories that I was writing after I left. You know what I mean? Because, and I'm not saying that they were good or bad. I'm just saying that I had a kind of idea of how to expand maybe the line of reporting of my little kind of niche. And that was what it was. And I think, you know, if you read a publication like Billboard, for example, which is the Bible for anyone who's into music, I think it's very interesting to see how they branch out and talk about this or that artist. And I think it has a lot to do with the personality of their writers in the newsroom as well. I saw an article the other day on the website about Jimmy Barnes, you know,
A well-known
and about
Australian singer.
well-known Australian singer. And I'm like, and I'm gonna I'm gonna put a dollar in the jar. But and then immediately after reading about Jimmy Barnes, because he had to stop his tour because he was
Was
ill or
unwell,
something.
yes.
That's right. Well, so did Tina Arena. And I went and actually went and checked the history of all the stories that had been published about Tina Arena on Billboard and thought to myself, why does a story about Jimmy Barnes? I mean, I can go down the street in Louisville, Kentucky, and ask 1,000 people. I don't think a single one will know. With all due respect to Jimmy
No,
Barnes, I don't
absolutely.
think a single person will know who he is. I know who he is, and I was actually taken aback and thought to myself, And then, you know, with the whole thing of the world rediscovering Sophie Ellis Bextor, you know, and I was reading an article about this, and maybe we can talk about this in a separate show, but about how international music has become. That was on Billboard as well. And I'm like, but music has always been international. It's just that different people were paying attention and some people weren't. So I.
Exactly. And it comes back to that access, you know. So
Yes.
if you didn't go and buy an album in the old days, like I would have to go into Brushes, which was really back in the old days in Australia, or JB Hi-Fi or Sanity. And I'd have to,
Yes. Oh,
I'd have
Sanity.
to d actively look for a French album.
Right.
If they had French albums, I wouldn't even know what I'm looking for. Now I can go onto Spotify and type in French playlist or French top
That's
10.
right.
So I think it's that access. And, if we look at the resurgence of Kate Bush coming out of Stranger Things with her song, Sophie Ellis Bextor coming out of, oh my gosh, isn't that terrible? I've got a complete blank about the movie, which I absolutely adored.
Salt burn.
Saltburn. And it's funny because, 2 years ago, I kept saying to people, oh, we're going to Sophie Ellis Bextor, oh my God, we're going to a private concert of 100 people. No, and no one knew. Either they went, oh, is she still around? Either they didn't know her, or they knew her thinking she had that one song 20 years ago and went, oh, she's still around. And I would probably put Sophie Ellis Bextor in. I get just as defensive about her. And I'd say, she's released a lot of albums. Her music's amazing. That's not even one of
It
her best
is.
songs. But it's this access through things that now people can hear it in the movie and then they can jump online and listen to it. And that takes me back to things like the New York Times posting that article about Will Taylor get from Japan to the Super Bowl, where, these media organizations are driven by click rates because they need to show their sponsors that they're getting the
Yes.
visitation to their website. We know about clickbait being, that tempting title that makes you click on it and read the article that probably has nothing to do with what the title was.
That's
So,
right.
I think there probably is there a tendency now that these news articles do have to have these certain batch because they know if New York Times publishes that, they're going to get hits and clicks on their website.
Oh,
They can show their
absolutely.
advertisers our visitation and circulation is up.
And
So how much
everyone.
that is impacting editorial decisions that it wouldn't have in the past.
And everyone is being asked about Taylor Swift these days, even, I mean, or about Travis Kelce. I mean, I saw a Snapchat of President Biden being asked about whether he preferred Jason or Travis, and then he answered that he preferred Mama Kelce. So, you know, it's very much in, you know, and then I think there was a parallel that struck me of Taylor Swift plus Travis Kelce plus Jason Kelce plus Ky Jason and Kylie, which is so funny to me to have a Jason and Kylie again. But
for our
But
Australian
all
or
the
English
entire
listeners will know that reference.
That's right. The entire family of, Taylor Swift and the whole Kelce family kind of drew parallel with me with the Kardashians, because a few years ago you couldn't click on, and then I think it's the only precedent in recent pop culture where media outlets were desperate to link any and every story with the Kardashians one way or the other. And they are trying to do the same with Taylor Swift today. Think what you will about the Kardashians, you could not escape the Kardashians if you tried to. So they were everywhere. And then this whole tentacular kind of family dynamic very much kind of replicated when the Super Bowl happened and Taylor Swift was there and Mama Kelce was there. And Jason was there. So I think, and Jason, quoting All Too Well in his retirement speech at a conference that had nothing to do with, Taylor whatsoever. So, I mean, there is also people are kind of bringing that into their narrative as well. It's not a coincidence that, Jason
No,
Kelce quoted that song.
absolutely. And we might do an episode maybe on families in pop culture. And we can go
Absolutely.
back to, I mean, obviously the Jacksons, but the Osmonds. We can look at Judy Garland and even early on in cinema and those studio stars and then their families and how that sort of those dynasties and then
That's
how they're
right.
actually portrayed through the media and how people connected to them tie in. But I'm conscious of time.
And do I have time for one more question for you?
You do, yes. I'll
Okay.
answer it
No,
quickly.
because we Yes, but we've spoken about this in the past because I see negative comments from your average Joe on social networks and people who are uninterested. I do not necessarily see negative media coverage on Taylor Swift. When I mean negative, I mean ne coverage
Mainstream media.
criticizing mainstream media. I think, we live in a world where there's a kind of a deification of some people out there in the pop culture world where they've become icons and they're untouchable and you can't say anything negative about them. And I think that, Taylor Swift has kind of reached that level of, you can't say anything negative about her. I'm curious to know what you think the negative coverage is.
That's really interesting, and I was thinking about this because, I think there's the mainstream coverage and there's the coverage, the media coverage, and I say that inverted commas, that you see on things like Instagram and Facebook, which if, of course you only see what your algorithms are showing you. So I'm never going to
That's
be
right.
able to see a really balanced spread of what the coverage is. I'm going to stick. I'm going to be given the coverage my algorithm thinks I want, which is not a comprehensive, obviously, view. I think there was definitely, I mean, not, I think there was definitely negative media coverage from what I would say would be the more conservative right-wing media in Australia around her. So that's a whole other conversation we could go into. There was certainly, but that same right-wing media were also propping her up and building the jubilation and the phenomenon. So there's no consistency. The same publication could print seven positive articles about her and seven negative. You don't get the tone like you used to perhaps from a newspaper of what their editorial stance was. So yes, I don't no, I wouldn't say it was negative. I've certainly seen negative coverage of her, but in the mainstream media, I would say on the whole, it was positive. Now, I would
What would
like to,
you? Yeah, go ahead.
just because we've got 5 minutes left.
Yes. No, very clear. What would you? Is there anything that you would do differently, or anything that strikes you as a bit off that you would, if the team, Taylor Swift's team, came to you and asked for some advice or anything? Is there anything that you would do differently? Because you asked me about how I would cover
Yes.
the whole thing.
What I was interested in, and we might do this in our next podcast, is I was very interested in what media interviews she would give when she came to Australia, because
Right.
and what I was trying to think what media would be the right platform for her to go on. And of course, she did no interviews while she was here. And I know I want to have that discussion with you at another time around artists
Are there
having
going to be any interviews with the
what
release
the
of the new album is also a question.
exactly and what those
She doesn't need to.
What those commitments or what those, you know, is there a responsibility of an artist to do media that isn't around them trying to drive ticket sales to their concert or to buy their album? No, I don't think there's anything I would do differently. Well, I would tell them to have more concerts so we can get more tickets. But I'm really curious to see what they're going to do over the next 2 years.
Right.
Like I would actually love to be in that planning meeting and understand what they're planning, because we know the planning's long term. You know, nothing happens by chance with Taylor and her team.
I would say release fewer formats of the albums. I cannot deal with 20 different formats of one
No,
album
but
anymore.
I'm going to
And
throw
she's
that.
not the only one doing it. She's not the only
Correct,
one doing it.
exactly. Yes. So I think we should have a whole conversation, because you always bring insights to me around those releases of those albums which are done to drive up record sales. So I'd like to explore that in another episode and talk about those special releases, because we know Kylie does them, we know Madonna does them, we know Taylor does them. And I guess speaking of records, I'd like to end by asking you your perhaps top three Taylor songs.
That's an interesting one. I love doing playlists in my head, so I've actually already thought of this. I musically one of my favorite songs, because I'm a huge fan of R&B, and I find that that one is a bit R&B leaning in terms of the delivery of the vocals. I think it's Delicate from Reputation. I think it's a great song. But that's really just, I'm not talking about discourse analysis here. I'm not talking about, what we've been talking about for more than an hour now. But yes, I like Delicate. And it's actually probably the first Taylor Swift song that I actually could say I really liked. Then I warmed up to Blank Space, which had been released before, and talk about flipping the narrative and kind of, bringing the criticism into your lyrics and flipping things around. I think that's a very interesting, smart, clever song. And in the same kind of genre, I love The Man, because I think it's a
Yes.
very interesting kind of the song, the music video, the fact that Taylor Swift directed the music video herself. I think there's a lot around that song that is very interesting, and it's also very catchy, that one. And I think I like the songs that actually suit her voice really well. I think The Man is really one that does. What about you?
Well, I'm going to agree with you on The Man. I love The Man. I love Blank Space. That's probably always been one of my favorites, because I just actually find it a really catchy tune. The
Right.
Man, because I love the lyrics and I think it is such a clever song. I also like Anti-Hero because of the lyrics. It's not that I love the tune, but I actually like the lyrics in it. I'm
Right.
coming back to Love Story, as just enjoying that, and I know it's one of your favorites. Not
Not really.
really, but I actually just find it a really fun song. But then I actually also I'm going to add in Cruel Summer, but I only like Cruel Summer because
Oh.
of the experience she has built at the concert around
Right.
the singing of the bridge in that song, and she's created such a moment. So isn't that interesting that that song has really got me from watching clips at the concert? And I remember when her concert was on in Melbourne, and my partner and I, you know, were sitting at home because we hadn't got tickets, but we were desperately looking up, well, I was looking them up and sending them to him, every hashtag to try and we just wanted to see her singing Cruel Summer at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. So, you know,
Right.
she's even created these experiences out of her concerts that have drawn me in for particular songs and made me experience a song in a different way that I would have if I'd just heard it on an album.
I love Teddy Swims' cover of that song. I had just had to say that.
Yes, and maybe we can add that each episode a version of a song that we recommend. So on that note, I think it is time for us to wrap up this inaugural episode of our podcast. It's been
That's
lovely
right.
chatting with you.
Absolutely lovely chatting with you as well. I hope this is just an indication of things to come for us and listeners, if you have any topics that you would like us to delve into and give our take on from a journalist's and a communication specialist's perspectives, by all means, please let us know. We'll be happy to go into those topics with you at a later date. Coming to you from Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Vikin Karkukli.
And coming to you from Melbourne, Australia, I'm Georgie Statius. And as we end this episode, I'd like to note that the tally in the Tina Arena mention jar is $2 so far.
That's right.
We expect it to grow rapidly. Maybe
It will.
you could have the Tina Arena, I'll have the Taylor Swift and Sophie Ellis-Bextor jar.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Thank you for listening.
Thank you
Thank you for
all.
talking. Bye.